So it is May 2026. And picture this, a massive, like, freak spring storm just wiped out the main high-voltage transmission line feeding your entire county.
Yeah, absolute nightmare scenario for any local planner.
Right. And in the old days, I mean, like 5 years ago, you would be staring at a week of just absolute darkness.
Oh, easily.
You'd be looking at, millions of dollars in lost local revenue, hospitals running on fumes, and a municipal water treatment plant on the brink of complete catastrophic failure.
Yeah, total chaos.
But today, right now, in this scenario, the lights in the emergency room didn't even flicker.
Not even a dip in voltage. I mean, the pumps at the water plant are still cycling perfectly,
Wow.
and the local grocery store hasn't lost a single frozen item.
Because the game has fundamentally changed. And if you're listening to this, whether you are a local leader, a municipal planner staring down a totally depleted tax base, or, just an incredibly curious citizen who's tired of feeling helpless every time the wind blows too hard, the terror of a grid collapse.
Absolutely. Everyone knows that sinking feeling when the lights go out.
So today's deep dive is entirely focused on a new mission. We are going to explore how your community can ditch these fragile, centralized power grids, future-proof your critical services, and actually take back control of your utility revenues using decentralized infrastructure.
And we are pulling from a massive stack of source material today to do this.
What are we looking at?
It's from an organization called Dereticular. We're going through their engineering white papers, strategic SWOT analyses, deployment roadmaps, and some really striking visual design briefs.
They've mapped out the whole thing.
Exactly. It all details a transition away from the hyperscale, centralized cloud and grid models that, totally dominated the 20th century.
Right.
They call this new paradigm sovereign autonomous infrastructure.
Sovereign autonomous infrastructure. Okay. To really understand why this shift is happening, I feel like we need to look at why the old system is failing us so spectacularly.
Yeah, you have to diagnose the disease first.
Totally. I was trying to picture the modern centralized utility grid. And the best image I could come up with is like a cheap old string of holiday lights.
Oh, that's a perfect analogy.
Right. They're wired in series. You string them up, they look great. But the moment one single tiny bulb somewhere in the middle breaks, the entire street goes dark.
Yep, the whole thing goes down.
So, how did we build our entire civilization on a system that fragile? How do we stop that domino effect?
Well, it really comes down to a historical engineering philosophy. For over a century, civil engineering and regional planning have relied on what the Dereticular sources call linear concentration.
Linear concentration.
Yeah, so when you're building a massive coal plant or a nuclear facility, you obviously have to build it far away from population centers.
Makes sense. You don't want a nuclear plant downtown.
Exactly. So you create a hub and spoke model. We rely on high voltage transmission lines carrying power hundreds of miles. And it's the same for telecom, too. We use single path, long haul fiber optic backbones for our internet and single source municipal water mains.
So the centralized source generates the power, sends it down the line to node A, which passes it to node B, then node C, all the way down the line to your house.
And that structure creates a mathematical vulnerability.
Okay, lay it on me.
The white papers break this down using graph theory.
Oh boy, graph theory.
It's actually not that bad. If you imagine drawing a network on a chalkboard representing substations or data centers as dots and the physical power lines as the lines connecting them,
Okay, I'm picturing it.
a traditional linear or tree-structured utility network has an edge connectivity of exactly one.
Meaning there is only one single path between the source and the destination.
Right, which means the shortest path between any two nodes relies entirely on a non-redundant route.
So if a transmission tower blows over in a storm,
Or a backhoe accidentally severs a fiber line.
it happens all the time.
It really does. Or a transit router gets hit by a cyber attack. If any of that happens, that single edge is broken.
And the graph is partitioned.
Exactly. The graph is suddenly partitioned into disconnected subgraphs. The system collapses downstream from the break.
And the math the sources provide on this is completely unforgiving.
Oh, it's brutal.
They show that as the geographical scale of the network grows, as you add more miles of wire and more vulnerable substations, the probability of a systemic partition event approaches 100%.
It literally becomes a mathematical certainty.
Wow.
The equation illustrates that as physical links increase toward infinity, the probability of a partition approaches one.
So it's guaranteed to break.
Yeah, that renders long-haul linear transmission systems statistically prone to interruption. It is never a matter of if the grid will fail.
It is only a question of when and where and how much economic damage it will cause.
Exactly.
Okay, so I want to dig into the alternative because the DeRiticular papers contrast this linear fragility with a concept they call spherical resilience.
Yes. This is where it gets really interesting.
How does that actually change the physical flow of power?
Well, spherical resilience completely abandons that edge connectivity of one. Instead, it introduces a K-connected mesh.
A K-connected mesh.
Right. In graph theory, a spherically resilient network is modeled as a K-vertex-connected and K-edge-connected graph, where the value of K is greater than or equal to 3.
Wait, so instead of one path, every single point on the grid has at least 3 separate redundant pathways feeding into it.
At a bare minimum, yes.
That's a huge shift.
It is. In this architecture, for any single community or node to lose power, at least 3 independent paths, often coming from entirely different directions and sources, would have to fail simultaneously.
Which is way less likely.
Exponentially less likely. The probability of isolation drops drastically because it becomes the product of the failure probabilities of each independent path.
The design brief has a brilliant visual for this. I love this part.
Oh, yeah, the topographical map.
Yeah. It describes this glowing 3D topographical map of an agricultural county. You see all these glowing dots representing local utility hubs.
Like a living network.
Exactly. Then a prominent red X flashes, showing a severed main upstream transmission line.
Which is usually game over.
Right. Under the old linear model, everything past that X instantly goes black. But in this visual, the local network just instantly reroutes.
It heals itself.
Yeah, the power flows through dense, multi-directional local pathways, and the whole community stays online.
It shows the system actively self-healing. By ensuring that echo is greater than or equal to 3, you effectively engineer single points of failure completely out of existence.
So the intelligence in the network simply routes around the physical break.
Exactly.
So we are moving from a highly fragile, rigid tree branch to like an indestructible, multi-directional spider web.
I like that, yes.
If a branch falls and tears a hole in a rigid net, the net fails. But if you pluck one thread of a spider web, the whole web absorbs the tension.
It redistributes.
Right. The power instantly finds the path of least resistance around the broken thread without overloading the rest of the structure.
That captures the load distribution perfectly. A spider web doesn't snap, you know, it redistributes the force.
But let's play devil's advocate for a second.
Go for it.
To make this mathematical spider web work in the real world, you can't just string up redundant wires and call it a day.
No, definitely not.
The individual dots on that web, the local hubs themselves, need to actually have something to share.
Right.
If the macro grid goes down and a massive power plant goes offline, redundant connections don't help if there's no electricity flowing through them in the first place.
That is the crucial pivot from theory to physical engineering. And it introduces a mechanism the sources call island mode.
Island mode.
Yes. This is the foundational behavior of a spherically resilient network.
Okay. I really want to slow down and explore the mechanics of island mode. Because this isn't just about turning on a backup generator out back.
No, it's way faster and smarter than that.
The white papers describe a local infrastructure node detecting an upstream anomaly and physically severing its connection to the macro grid in milliseconds.
Speed is literally the difference between survival and a blown transformer here.
Milliseconds, though.
How? They utilize solid-state automatic transfer switches.
As opposed to?
Older mechanical switches. Those take seconds to flip. And in the world of industrial power, a few seconds of voltage drop is enough to crash a hospital's ventilators.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, or permanently damage the variable frequency drives on a municipal water pump.
No, she can't wait seconds.
Not at all. Solid-state switches operate in milliseconds. The instant the upstream connectivity drops below a strict quality of service threshold, the local node activates its internal control loop and cuts the cord.
It just chops off the dead weight.
Exactly.
The papers use a really fascinating mathematical variable to explain this, the autonomy factor.
Represented by the Greek letter sheta.
Right.
The autonomy factor dictates how reliant a piece of infrastructure is on its neighbors. In a traditional legacy network, the autonomy factor is practically zero.
Meaning total reliance.
Yes. A legacy substation cannot function without real-time inputs from the centralized grid. It relies on the massive spinning turbines hundreds of miles away to provide the 60 hertz clock signal and the high voltage reference lines.
So it is physically tethered to the health of the entire grid.
Totally tethered.
Which means if a neighboring town's grid fails, All of their electrical load suddenly sloshes over to your town substation.
And if that sudden influx of load exceeds the operating capacity of your substation, what happens?
It trips its safety breakers.
And it shuts down. Then the load sloshes to the next town.
That is the cascade failure.
That is exactly what a cascade failure is. That is why a single tree falling in Ohio once blacked out the entire eastern seaboard.
That's insane when you think about it.
Because the autonomy factor is zero, the infrastructure is just a victim of its environment.
But in the dereticular system, when that solid state switch flips, an island mode is activated.
The autonomy factor shifts from zero to one.
From victim to completely independent.
Mathematically, when theta equals one, the probability of a cascading system failure propagating into that specific node drops to absolute zero.
Because it stops listening to the dying grid. It mathematically bounds the failure.
Exactly. By containing its own local load and physically generating its own 60 hertz reference voltage locally, the node refuses to let a regional fault drag it down.
It establishes its own baseline reality.
That's a great way to put it, yeah.
The sources include a visual they call contrasted resiliency, and it really drives the physical reality of this home.
It's a very striking image.
Imagine a split-screen perspective during a massive regional blackout. You're looking at a stormy twilight sky. In the background, the entire surrounding town, the streetlights, the neighborhoods, just pitch black.
Total darkness.
But in the foreground, a critical municipal water treatment plant is fully illuminated. The pumps are whining, water is flowing.
Business as usual.
And powering it all is this rugged shipping container sitting on a concrete pad, glowing with status LEDs.
That right there is the physical manifestation of island mode.
The node isolated the fault to its origin and is carrying the vital load of the water plant entirely on its own shoulders.
Yeah, so island mode isn't about being stranded on a desert island waiting for rescue.
Right, it's more like a submarine automatically sealing off a flooded compartment.
Oh, perfect.
It isolates the damage instantly, so the rest of the ship and the sealed compartment itself, if it has its own life support, can actually survive the pressure.
It is active, intentional isolation for the sake of survival. It bounds the failure before the water can spread.
All right, I'm sold on the concept. Bounding the failure makes perfect sense.
Good.
But let's be real here. If we want a municipal water treatment plant or an ICU to actually survive off-grid in the middle of a storm, we aren't running it on math equations and metaphors.
You need the gear.
We need serious, heavy-duty hardware. We need a machine capable of operating a microgrid without a team of centralized engineers holding its hand.
Which brings us to the core physical asset of this entire architecture.
The box.
Yes. The dereticular design briefs call it the infrastructure in a box, or formally, the phase zero node.
I want to pull apart the anatomy of this phase zero node, starting with the physical footprint.
It's surprisingly compact.
Because for a municipal planner listening right now, when they hear substation upgrade, they are picturing a three-year civil engineering nightmare, pouring acres of concrete and millions in consulting fees.
Oh yeah, endless bureaucracy.
But this phase zero node is literally a standard 20-foot iCube ISO shipping container.
Just a standard intermodal container. The choice of that form factor is ruthlessly pragmatic.
How so?
By engineering everything inside a standardized shipping container, you bypass almost all of the bespoke civil engineering delays.
Oh, because it fits on existing trucks.
Exactly. It can be transported via the existing global supply chain, rail car, cargo vessel, or a standard flatbed truck.
So no specialized wide load permits?
None. You pour a basic concrete pad, crane the container into place, and you can commission the entire system in a matter of days, not years.
That is wild. And the power specs packed into this single 20-foot box are staggering. Let's look at the generation side first.
Okay.
Attached to the container is a 150-kilowatt bifacial monocrystalline solar array.
Bifacial is key here.
Why is that? What does bifacial actually mean?
It captures direct sunlight on the front of the panels, but it also captures the ambient light reflecting off the ground onto the rear of the panels.
Oh, so it grabs light from both sides.
Yeah, which significantly boosts the overall energy yield. And it doesn't require complex manual assembly either.
How does it set up?
It utilizes an integrated mechanical scissor jack mounting system.
Like a car jack?
Sort of, yeah.
Yeah.
It folds completely flat against the sides of the container during transit. Then it automatically extends to the optimal angle once deployed on site.
Wow. So it basically unpacks itself.
Exactly.
Okay, so that handles the generation during the day. But we need to power the hospital at night. The sources specify a 400 kilowatt hour lithium iron phosphate battery system.
LiFePO4.
Yes, LiFePO4.
The chemical selection here is incredibly deliberate and vital for municipal safety.
I was wondering about that. Why does that specific chemistry matter? Why not just use the NMC, the nickel manganese cobalt bonate batteries we see in, like, most electric cars?
Because of thermal stability.
Meaning fire risk.
Exactly. NMC batteries are very energy dense, but if they are physically punctured or suffer a manufacturing defect, they can experience thermal runaway.
They explode.
They can burst into an inextinguishable chemical fire.
Yikes.
Right. And if you are dropping a massive container of batteries next to a dry rural forest or a crowded emergency shelter, fire risk is unacceptable.
Yeah, the mayor's not going to sign off on a potential bomb.
Definitely not. Lithium iron phosphate has a far higher thermal runaway threshold. It simply won't combust under the same stress.
Okay, that's a huge safety upgrade.
Add to that an operational lifespan of over 6,000 deep charge cycles and an automated aerosol-based fire suppression system built directly into the container.
So basically, if a tree falls on this container in the middle of a dry summer forest, it won't turn into a raging chemical inferno.
Exactly. It's safe.
That alone would ease a lot of municipal zoning anxieties. But what if the sun doesn't shine for a week? What if it's the dead of winter and the solar panels are useless?
DeReticular planned for extended anomalies.
They have a backup for the backup.
Tucked inside the container is a 30 kilowatt variable speed, hydrogen-ready auxiliary thermal generator.
So it has an internal combustion backup to recharge its own batteries.
Precisely. It provides baseload support when weather patterns prevent solar generation for multi-day stretches.
So it really won't die.
But perhaps the most impressive engineering feat is the climate durability of the entire unit.
Oh, right, the HVAC.
The sources detail dual redundant closed loop HVAC systems managing the internal temperature.
And the temperature ratings are insane. It operates from negative 30 degrees Celsius up to positive 55 degrees Celsius.
Yeah, that is negative 22 Fahrenheit to 131 Fahrenheit.
I mean, how does standard utility equipment handle those extremes?
It generally melts or freezes.
Just breaks down.
Yeah. We've seen centralized grid transformers fail massively during polar vortexes because their oil freezes.
Oh, right, like in Texas.
Exactly. Or during heat waves because their cooling systems just can't shed the ambient heat.
Right.
By utilizing a closed-loop HVAC system, the Phase Zero node isolates its sensitive power electronics and batteries from the external humidity and temperature extremes.
It's got its own perfect little ecosystem inside the box.
Precisely.
The visual design briefs have two incredible renderings that showcase this durability. The first is the winter resiliency test.
I love that rendering.
It paints a picture of this exact container deployed deep in a snow-blanketed mountain pass.
Just covered in snow.
Yeah. But the Scissorjack solar panels are pitched steeply, so the heavy snowfall just instantly slides off. And you can see a thin, clean whisk of thermal heat exhaust rising from that hydrogen generator.
It's completely unfazed by the weather.
Right. It's proving that it can deliver continuous steady power to whatever it's connected to, even in a whiteout blizzard.
And they deliberately contrast that extreme cold with an agricultural integration visual.
Right. You see a Phase Zero node sitting in the middle of a vast, dusty agricultural field under a blinding afternoon sun.
The dust everywhere.
It's independently powering a massive, high-capacity center pivot irrigation pump. The heavy power cables run straight from the container right into the pump house.
No utility poles anywhere in sight.
None. It visualizes the core promise, continuous service delivery, regardless of the environmental hostility or the fragility of the macro grid.
It just works, period.
Okay, I have to stop and push back on this.
Fair enough.
Because if I am a municipal leader, I am looking at this highly advanced, incredibly expensive shipping container full of lithium batteries and edge servers.
And you're terrified to put it in a field.
Exactly. I'm thinking, we're going to drop this in a remote rural field or a dark mountain pass.
Yeah.
Won't it just break down?
Or get graffitied or broken into.
Right. Get vandalized the second no one is looking. Rural municipalities aren't exactly overflowing with specialized battery chemical engineers who can drive out and fix a liquid-cooled inverter on a Tuesday night.
The SWOT analysis in the sources addresses this exact skepticism.
Okay, what do they say?
They openly acknowledge a significant deficit in advanced electrical and edge compute maintenance skills within rural and municipal workforces.
So they admit it's a problem.
Yes. It is a genuine weakness of deploying decentralized hardware.
So how do they mitigate the fact that small towns don't have Silicon Valley hardware engineers on the payroll?
Through aggressive physical hardening and modular standardization.
Hardening, meaning making it tough.
Exactly. First, the exterior isn't just standard corrugated tin. It is an 8-gauge Corten steel shell.
Corten steel, like shipping containers.
Well, much thicker. Corten steel actually forms a stable, rust-like appearance that resists deep corrosion. It's highly resistant to environmental wear, ballistic impact, and unauthorized entry.
Ballistic impact, so it can take a bullet.
Yes. The access panels use heavy-duty physical locking mechanisms, and the entire perimeter is monitored by integrated optical and thermal cameras linked to the software system.
Okay, so the box itself is basically a bank vault.
Pretty much.
But what happens when something breaks inside the vault? Like a circuit board fails.
That is where they minimize the skills gap. The internal architecture uses FRUs.
FRUs.
Field replaceable units.
Break that down for me.
Instead of a sprawling mess of custom wires and soldered circuit boards, the server racks, the battery modules, and the solar charge controllers are designed as standardized sealed drawers.
Drawers. Like a filing cabinet.
Exactly. Let's say the internal diagnostics detect that a specific battery cell string is degrading faster than expected.
Yeah.
The node issues an encrypted alert to the municipal maintenance team.
So a local public works technician drives out there.
Yeah.
Do they need a voltmeter and an engineering degree?
Not at all. They don't diagnose chemical degradation or solder microchips. They simply bring out a replacement FRU module, unlock the rack, slide the degraded drawer out, and slide the new one in.
Oh.
The system automatically registers the new hardware.
It is literal plug-and-play infrastructure.
It reduces high-level engineering maintenance down to basic mechanical swap-outs. Anyone can do it.
All right. So the steel box is practically indestructible, and a standard mechanic can swap the parts.
Exactly.
But hardware is ultimately just dumb metal without the right instructions.
Very true.
If these nodes are completely air-gapped in a valley with no internet access, how do they actually know what to do?
That's the software piece.
Right. If there's no central cloud telling the battery when to discharge or the solar panels when to curtail, how does a box in a field balance a microgrid?
That brings us to the software layer. And honestly, the software is arguably a more revolutionary leap than the hardware.
That's a big claim.
The brain running this entire operation is called RIOS.
The Rural Infrastructure Operating System.
Exactly. The sources define RIOS as an edge-native, real-time, microkernel operating system.
Lots of buzzwords there.
I know, but the most critical aspect of RIOS is that it was designed from the ground up to operate under fully air-gapped conditions.
Meaning it assumes the internet is dead from day one?
Precisely. The legacy model of the last 20 years, the hyperscale cloud model, assumes you have massive uninterrupted fiber optic backhaul connecting every smart device back to a billion-dollar data center in Virginia.
Right. And if that connection drops, your smart device becomes a paperweight.
Yeah, it just blinks at you. RIOS is engineered for the inverse reality. It assumes connectivity is a luxury, not a given.
Let's dig into how RIOS actually manages communication when things get chaotic. The papers detail a component called the signal fusion engine.
This is how it solves the telecommunications gap.
Okay.
Legacy substations usually rely on a single fiber line or a microwave link. If a storm takes that out, the utility goes blind.
Which happens all the time.
All the time. The signal fusion engine continuously monitors an array of physical communication interfaces simultaneously.
Like what?
We are talking low Earth orbit satellite uplinks, local private LTE transceivers, and long-range radio frequency mesh networks.
So it's constantly looking at the sky, sniffing the local cell towers, and pinging radio frequencies all at the exact same time.
Yes. And it isn't just looking at them.
What is it doing?
It is actively evaluating the signal-to-noise ratio, the packet loss, and the jitter across all available pathways.
Very smart.
It dynamically routes data packets over the optimal interface millisecond by millisecond.
Wow.
If the storm clouds block the LEO satellite, the signal fusion engine instantly shards the data and pushes it over the RF mesh to a neighboring node that might have a clearer view of the sky.
It's hunting for any possible way to get the message out seamlessly.
Exactly.
But communication is just the nervous system.
Yeah.
The actual brain. The part making the decisions when the grid collapses is what they call the Autonomous Machine Coordination Engine, the AMC.
The AMC engine is where the magic happens during island mode.
Walk me through it.
When the solid state switch severs the connection to the dying macro grid, the AMC engine instantly takes over all localized industrial controls.
Okay.
It runs edge AI machine learning models deployed directly on the local server to balance local power generation against the critical loads of the facility.
And the sources give a fantastic example of the math this engine has to do in real time.
The water tower one.
Yeah. Imagine a phase zero node hooked up to a municipal water system. The AMC engine has to calculate the hydrostatic pressure of the town's water tower.
Right.
Factor in how much solar energy is currently hitting the panels. Check the depletion rate of the LiFePO4 batteries.
Yep.
And decide exactly which non-essential residential circuits to load shed, all within fractions of a second to prevent the water pumps from stalling out.
And it has to do all of that coordination across multiple nodes using local consensus protocols.
Right.
The white paper specifically highlight algorithms like modified RAFT or PBFT.
Wait, slow down. RAFT and PBFT.
I know, alphabet soup.
Explain that to me like I'm a five-year-old.
Yeah.
Because if there is no central boss server telling all these nodes what to do, how do they not descend into total chaos?
Let's use an analogy.
Please do.
PBFT stands for Practical Byzantine Fault Tolerance.
Sounds intense.
Imagine a town council trying to vote on an emergency measure in a massive dark room.
Okay.
There's no mayor to make the final call, and some of the council members might be asleep or maybe even actively lying.
Sounds like a normal town council.
Right. So PBFT is a mathematical system of passing notes.
Passing notes.
The nodes constantly send cryptographic proofs to each other, verifying their state. I have 50% battery. I acknowledge you have 50% battery.
So they talk to each other to confirm reality.
Even if a few nodes in the local mesh are destroyed or malfunctioning, the surviving nodes can reach a mathematical consensus on the true state of the microgrid.
So they don't need the mayor.
No.
They don't need the massive hyperscale cloud in Virginia to tell them how to balance the load. They figured it out amongst themselves at the edge.
And what makes this truly disruptive is that the sources emphasize this is all built on commodity hardware and open source infrastructure.
Like Linux and Kubernetes.
Yes.
Why does commodity hardware matter so much?
Because it obliterates the barrier to entry.
Meaning cost.
Cost and availability. Yeah. You don't need a custom silicon supercomputer to run a microgrid anymore. You can run modern quantized edge AI models on standard off-the-shelf refurbished servers.
Or consumer-grade ARM processors.
Exactly.
The design brief has a visual for this that I found genuinely stunning. It's called the Municipal Edge Compute Rack.
That's a great image.
It shows the inside of the shipping container. Tucked into the wall is this IP67-rated, totally dustproof server rack.
Just glowing in there.
Yeah. Behind a heavy plexiglass panel, you see three standard rack mount servers running the Ryos software.
Yeah.
You can see the blue and amber status LEDs flickering.
It looks so futuristic, but it's built from standard parts.
It has physical hardware security modules for cryptography. It's just sitting there in the dark, managing the town's water pressure, executing load shedding algorithms, and communicating via satellite entirely on its own.
That rack represents true sovereign data.
Sovereign data, I like that.
It is community-retained compute resources. And the white papers highlight a profound strategic advantage here, specifically for developing nations or underfunded rural regions.
The leapfrog dynamic.
Yes.
I was fascinated by this concept. Walk us through how a rural farming town actually has an advantage over a massive city like New York in this transition.
It comes down to the burden of legacy infrastructure.
Okay.
Massive centralized systems require incredibly expensive, entrenched legacy hardware. Developing regions or rural towns that have been ignored by utility monopolies lack this dense infrastructure.
Right. They don't have all the old wires in the ground.
Exactly. But just as we saw entire continents skip the arduous process of laying copper landline telephone networks and jump straight to mobile cellular networks.
Oh, right. Because they didn't have landlines to begin with.
These municipalities can skip building massive centralized substations. They can leapfrog directly into sovereign autonomous edge infrastructure.
Because they aren't chained to billion-dollar sunk costs of the old way, they can adopt the resilient new way incredibly fast.
Exactly.
We are taking the brain power of a Silicon Valley data center, shrinking it down into a dustproof rack, and dropping it directly into the neighborhood where the work actually needs to happen.
It is the ultimate decentralization of intelligence and control.
All right. The steel box is rugged.
Very.
The software is brilliant. It can operate completely autonomously in a blizzard while dodging falling trees and balancing water pressure.
Yeah.
But we have to talk about the absolute biggest elephant in the room.
Let's do it.
Because if I am a municipal planner or a local mayor listening right now. The hardest part of infrastructure isn't the thermal rating of a battery.
Definitely not.
It isn't the edge compute consensus algorithm.
It is the budget.
It is always the budget.
Oh.
How on earth does a municipality afford a fleet of highly advanced AI-driven microgrid containers?
It's a huge hurdle.
If we look at the legacy baseline, how towns currently build infrastructure asset finance is essentially a trap, isn't it?
The white papers outline this centralized utility funding trap with brutal clarity.
What does the trap look like?
Historically, if a town wanted to build resilient public infrastructure, it required massive upfront capital expenditure, or CapEx.
Millions of dollars just to start?
Tens of millions sometimes. We are talking about taking on sovereign debt, issuing multi-decade municipal bonds that cripple a town's balance sheet.
And begging for federal grant allocations.
Exactly. And the monopolies, the big utility conglomerates, they inherently favor high-density urban areas, right?
For sure. Because if you are going to spend $1 billion upgrading a grid, you want millions of paying customers packed into a small area to maximize your return on investment.
Exactly. And what does that mean for rural, semi-rural, or economically disadvantaged areas?
They get left behind.
They are systematically deprioritized. Their grid rots.
Wow.
And to add insult to injury, the monthly utility fees that the citizens in those communities pay are extracted completely out of the local economy and sent to the shareholders of multinational investor-owned utilities, or IOUs.
Wait, really? Every single time a local business or a family pays their electric bill, that money leaves the county forever.
Yes. It is a one-way extraction of wealth.
That's depressing.
But the economic paradigm shift detailed in the sources is the introduction of DPIN.
Decentralized physical infrastructure networks.
Yes.
This is the core why for any local leader listening to this. Explain how DPIN changes the flow of money.
DPIN models democratize the capital required to build infrastructure.
How?
Instead of waiting for a multi-billion dollar utility conglomerate to deem a town worthy of an upgrade,
right,
local governments, agricultural cooperatives, and public-private partnerships can crowdsource and fractionalize the capital to deploy these nodes.
Hold on, I need to challenge this.
Okay, go ahead.
You're telling me a town with a depleted tax base, struggling to pave its potholes, is just going to magically crowdsource a high-tech microgrid?
It's not magic.
That sounds like pure Silicon Valley crypto optimism. I mean, how does a town of 5,000 people actually pull off a multi-million dollar infrastructure project without getting scammed or going bankrupt?
That is exactly why Deriticular utilizes a microgrid as a service, or MaaS framework.
Okay, MaaS, explain that.
They aren't asking the town to raise $10 million to buy the hardware outright.
Oh, they aren't?
No. The MaaS model shifts the burden entirely from massive upfront CapEx to a predictable, manageable OpEx.
Operational expenditure.
Exactly.
Walk me through a hypothetical town budget doing this.
Under this arrangement, an institutional infrastructure investor, or maybe a specialized local cooperative, actually purchases and owns the physical phase zero hardware.
Okay, so the big guys handle the CapEx.
They handle the CapEx. They then lease the operational capacity of that node to the municipality under a long-term power purchase agreement or a capacity service contract.
So the town just pays a monthly fee for the service rather than buying the box?
Correct. The community pays a predictable fixed utility fee.
Like they already do.
Exactly. And the sources stress that because of the localized efficiencies, this fee is engineered to be equivalent to, or often lower than, their historical macro utility bills.
So the town gets state-of-the-art, blackout-proof power for the same price they were paying the monopoly for a fragile grid.
Sometimes even less.
But here is the most transformative part, and this is what local leaders really need to grasp. It is about retaining utility revenue and data sovereignty locally.
This is the true economic leverage.
How does that work?
Under the DPIN model, ownership of the physical node is fractionalized on transparent digital ledgers.
Okay.
Over time, as the node operates, it inevitably generates surplus solar power or possesses excess edge compute cycles.
Because it's over-engineered for safety.
Exactly. That excess capacity isn't just wasted. It is actively traded peer-to-peer locally within the Deriticular mesh.
Wait, explain that. If the node powering the municipal water plant is generating more solar power on a sunny Tuesday than the pumps actually need, what happens to that power?
Through the RIO software, it instantly sells that excess power directly to the node powering the local hospital down the street or the high school.
Oh, wow. So the economic value, the revenue generated from the energy and data, stays circulating within the region's borders.
Yep.
It doesn't get extracted by an IOU in another state.
Exactly. And the municipality or the local cooperative can use that generated revenue to incrementally purchase ownership shares of the local node.
Oh.
They can buy it over time.
Right. Over a designated period, they can transition from just leasing the equipment to transferring complete sovereign asset ownership to the community itself.
There is a visual concept in the design brief called community-owned DePIN node that strips away all the technical jargon and grounds this reality perfectly.
The Town Hall one.
Yes. It's not a rendering of tech bros in a sleek boardroom.
It's a realistic, documentary-style photo of a town hall meeting. You see local community leaders, a cooperative farmer in a worn jacket, and a municipal planner with blueprints spread out over a folding table.
Just real people.
Yeah, they're standing around a newly deployed Phase Zero node. They aren't just passive ratepayers anymore.
They're owners.
They are co-investors who literally own a dividend-paying piece of their town's physical resilience.
It grounds the economics in profound civic reality. It demonstrates democratic capital investment physically functioning in the real world.
We are essentially taking local energy, which has historically been a mandatory monthly tax we pay to a distant monopoly, and turning it into a local dividend-paying asset.
Hmm.
We're keeping the dollars in the county.
That is the fundamental promise of the DePIN economic model combined with spherical resilience.
Okay, we've covered the math, the hardware, the software, and the economics.
We've covered a lot.
And I have to be honestly, it all sounds incredibly utopian.
It does.
You get indestructible power, you keep the money local, you use edge AI to run it without human engineers. If the tech works this well and the economics are this favorable, why aren't these black boxes on every street corner right now?
That's the million-dollar question.
What is actually stopping a local mayor from doing this tomorrow morning?
The harsh reality of entrenched power.
Of course.
And to their credit, the dereticular sources provide a very objective, technically grounded SWOT analysis that addresses the friction head-on.
They don't sugarcoat it.
Not at all. There are massive systemic threats and operational weaknesses that have to be navigated.
Let's pull the curtain back on the strategic SWOT analysis. Let's look at the weaknesses first.
Okay. The most glaring weakness is the higher localized unit cost.
Meaning the per kilowatt cost.
Right. If you look at it purely on a dollar per kilowatt hour basis in a vacuum, generating power from a distributed microgrid node is more expensive than generating power from a massive centralized natural gas plant.
Right, because of economies of scale.
You lose the massive economies of scale that centralized generation provides.
But I suppose the counterargument is that the centralized model doesn't factor in the economic cost of a three-day blackout when the lines go down.
Exactly. The unit cost is higher, but the blended cost of resilience justifies it.
Makes sense.
We also already discussed the local technical skills deficit, which they mitigate with the modular FRU hardware.
Right, the drawers.
But the internal weaknesses aren't what stop these projects. It's the external threats.
The big guys. The biggest external threat mentioned is monopolistic utility pushback and regulatory compliance.
Monopolies do not surrender their monopolies willingly.
Shocker.
Right. Investor-owned utilities and established telecom conglomerates spend hundreds of millions lobbying heavily against independent microgrids.
Why do they hate them so much?
Because they view a community generating and sharing its own power as an existential threat to their ratepayer base.
If the town makes its own power, they don't get paid.
Exactly. The sources explicitly mention the nightmare of grid interconnection queues.
I know municipal planners who have tried to launch simple solar projects, and they tell me the red tape is designed to be fatal.
It is often intentionally prohibitive. In many jurisdictions, if a town wants to integrate a grid-tied generation system, the IOU legally subjects them to a localized impact study.
And how long does that take?
These interconnection studies can be delayed for 3, 4, even 5 years.
5 years just for a study.
Yep. And even if you survive the study, there's the Public Utility Commission, the PUC.
Oh, they do.
The PUC regulations are completely archaic. In many states, laws passed in the 1930s dictate that if you generate electricity and distribute it across a public street or right-of-way to multiple buildings, you are legally classified as an electrical corporation.
Wait, just for running a wire across the street?
Just for sharing power across a public right-of-way.
Which means you are suddenly subject to the exact same crushing regulatory compliance, legal liability, and administrative overhead as a multi-billion-dollar utility giant.
which effectively bankrupts and kills the municipal project before a single solar panel is ever deployed.
It's a trap.
A huge trap.
So how does D-Reticular actually propose navigating this minefield? If you can't plug your docks into the grid without a four-year study, and you can't share power across the street without becoming a legally classified utility, how do you actually deploy sovereign autonomous infrastructure?
They outline a very pragmatic, arguably brilliant deployment roadmap.
Let's hear it.
It is essentially a Trojan horse strategy designed to legally bypass the regulatory red tape. They call it the Phase Zero Behind the Meter, or BTM, deployment.
Okay, this is where the geopolitical chess match happens at the local level. Explain the mechanics of behind the meter.
The trick is isolation. Instead of trying to connect the D-Reticular node to the macro grid as an official power generator,
right,
you install the Phase Zero node directly on the private property of the municipal facility, say the water treatment plant.
Okay.
You wire it directly into the facility's localized service point, literally behind the utility meter that measures their usage.
So from the perspective of the giant monopoly's macro grid, this incredibly advanced multi-million dollar microgrid shipping container simply doesn't exist.
Legally and electrically, it is totally invisible.
Wow.
During normal daily operations, the node generates solar power, discharges its batteries, and offsets the facility's energy load, significantly lowering the electric bill.
Okay.
But it is hardware configured to strictly, absolutely never export a single watt of power back out to the macro grid.
And because it is not exporting power, and because it is only serving that one specific localized building,
it completely bypasses the utility connection study queue.
Brilliant.
The IOU has no legal jurisdiction to block a private backup system that doesn't export power. Furthermore, because it isn't crossing a public right-of-way, it completely avoids being classified as a public utility by the PUC.
It is a phenomenal regulatory workaround. You install the node purely under the guise of being a local private backup system just to dodge the red tape, but you are secretly planting the physical hardware seed for a fully independent, spherically resilient community grid down the line.
That is exactly the phased roadmap they lay out.
Walk me through the phases.
Phase one, which covers months 1 through 3, is the definition phase. The municipality maps out their critical resilience hubs, water pumps, emergency shelters, police dispatch.
Okay, identifying the targets.
Phase two, months 4 through 6, is the BTM deployment. You drop the units in behind the meter. You establish immediate island mode security for your vital services without triggering a single lengthy utility review.
The hardware's in place.
Yeah.
The vital services are secure.
Yes.
And then the trap springs in phase three.
Months 7 through 18, this is where you scale the mesh and activate the peer-to-peer networks.
How does that work legally, though?
While the hardware is sitting there running quietly, the legal landscape is slowly shifting. The sources explicitly reference emerging state policies like California's AB 2175, which are beginning to officially exempt certain community microgrids from strict utility status.
Oh, so the laws are finally catching up.
Exactly. As those policies catch up, you execute a remote update to the RIO software.
You literally flip a digital switch in the software.
And suddenly those isolated behind-the-meter nodes reach out and start talking to each other.
Wow.
They begin sharing power bidirectionally over the RF mesh, and they form that spherically resilient K-connected grid we talked about at the beginning.
It's like turning on the spider web all at once.
Exactly. You build the physical infrastructure incrementally, flying under the radar of the heaviest legacy regulations, and you interlink them into a sovereign grid the moment the legal frameworks modernize.
There is one final visual from the design brief that perfectly captures the profound urgency of this deployment strategy.
This one.
It's titled the Disaster Recovery Visual. It shows a massive, heavy-duty flatbed truck equipped with a hydraulic crane.
Oh, yes. That one is intense.
It is dropping one of these charcoal gray Phase Zero containers into a rural residential area that has just been utterly devastated by a hurricane. There are downed, splintered power poles everywhere. Emergency personnel are setting up triage tents in the mud.
It really highlights the absolute necessity of rapid deployment capability.
Yeah.
When the macro grid fails catastrophically and people are freezing or without water, you do not have years to wait for civil engineering cycles or PUC hearings.
You don't have 5 years for a study.
No. You need instant, uncompromising emergency recovery.
You bypass the red tape because, in that moment, the red tapes literally blew away with the storm. You just drop the steel box, flip the switch, and turn the lights back on.
And in doing so, you demonstrate the undeniable physical superiority of the decentralized model Once the lights are on, the community will never let you take that box away.
So, bringing this all together, what does this mean for the listener staring at their town's crumbling infrastructure?
It means there is a way out.
Right. Transitioning from a fragile, linear, legacy grid to a spherically resilient mesh isn't just a technical upgrade involving better batteries and smarter software.
Not at all.
It is a fundamental tectonic shift in economic power. Local leaders can use dip-in financing models and island mode architectures to protect their vital services, keep the water pumping during a blackout, drastically lower their capital costs, and retain their utility revenues right at home where they belong.
It represents the complete democratization of both infrastructure and the capital required to build it.
We started this deep dive talking about a broken system, a grid that feels like a cheap string of fragile holiday lights waiting for a single storm to plunge us into darkness.
A very grim picture.
But what we've explored today is a very clear, very physical cure. It's a cure built on graph theory math, 8-gauge quartz and steel, thermal stable lithium iron phosphate, and edge compute algorithms.
It is the actionable blueprint for municipal survival in a highly volatile century.
But I want to leave you, the listener, with one final mind-bending question to chew on as you look at those vulnerable wooden power lines outside your window today.
Oh, this is a big one.
We've spent this entire deep dive talking about towns, counties, and municipal water plants becoming autonomous. But think bigger.
Global.
What happens to global geopolitics and the massive leverage of centralized nation-states when the very concept of infrastructure, energy, telecom, and compute can no longer be centrally controlled, heavily sanctioned, or simply shut off by a distant authority?
That changes everything.
When every small town is a sovereign, self-sustaining island who actually rules the grid,